So, Blade Runner 2049 is upon us, for sale now, and I've been meaning to talk about this film in a little bit more depth. This is most definitely was my film of the year. It was a tremendous film. In fact, it was the only film I think that was tremendous from 2017. But we didn't really get much time to talk much about it, so I wanted to go a little bit more in depth about the film, in some of the scenes and characters that had an effect on me, and why I think it's so effective, and certainly effective as a true sequel to the original Blade Runner. some people might say, I mean, straight away, the beginning of the film starts very much like the original Blade Runner. You have the legend on screen, you know, the text appearing lets you know what's going on, where we are with society and with the corporations that are running the planet, but also where advances in technology are heading. And of course, it ends with, Blade Runners are still the people that are out there hunting down and retiring escaped replicants. But from there onwards, I mean, like with the first one, the first shot you get is of this sort of disembodied eye, but in the case of this film, it's not an eye that's already open, it's a closed eye that then opens, and then we get into it, and again, travelling landscapes, and we're treated to a whole array of visual beauty, which is always encouraging when you watch these films, and it's at daytime, so that juxtaposes against the original, which was at night times of flame everywhere. But this one, we're seeing the vast landscape of California, with the farming that goes on out into the far regions, and is here where we are introduced to our main character of Kay, played by Ryan Gosling, as he's on his way into the outer regions to hunt down a character played by Dave Bautista. So it's all, sort of familiar territory with, what's going on and what we expect. And I think Ryan Gosling does a terrific job for a very, very subdued performance. He's very good at playing the quiet characters. And every now and again, he is given the opportunity to sort of let loose with his rage, because he himself, as we're told, is a replicant. That gets called into question later on as the plot develops. A misguided development in his case in terms of how he deals with his own memories. But it's the supporting characters that really, really pull this one in for me. And in particular, a lot of the female supporting characters are where all the really interesting questions are raised in this film. So while I will mention other characters and events that happen in the film, I wanted to focus in on a couple of these characters, particularly the characters of Love and Joy. Love being the main antagonist. Well, actually, she's the main antagonist? No, she's the main henchman, but certainly the main physical antagonist of the film. And Joy is obviously, the main love interest of the main character, but they're not there just primarily for those reasons. In any sort of crappy shortened film, adventure, thriller, whatever you want to call it, they would be, and traditionally always have been, very thin characters. The love interest, the antagonist, or henchman type thing. But this film does so much more with those characters. There's so much depth going on here that you can read into. That is, it's core to what the film is about. And it's just very, very cleverly written, some of the character detail in here. So if I start off with the character of Joy, who, as I'm sure you know, is she's perhaps the biggest tease in this film, as I'll put it. Because the film it raises questions about what it is to be human, and technology, and the entwining of both of those things. Can something that was created from technology be human, or have human characteristics beyond just the look and basic emotions? And the character of Joy is instrumental with this argument in this film, because you can literally look at it both ways. You can look at it as technology gone too far, we as consumers going too far with our technology, but also perhaps technology reaching the point where it becomes indistinguishable between ourselves and what has been created. And that's the fine line they draw with the character of Joy. She's a hologram program that is tailored to your needs, So right away you think, well, she's just an AI that's attuned with Kay. He's purchased her and he's set her up to fit his personality. But you later see that she's a program so deeply that she grows with her lover. She makes decisions by herself, and many of them affect Kay in a hard way. They both coexist together and make the other's lives that much more, you know, each other's lives that much more meaningful. He even gets her an outdoor projection stick, which basically means that she can leave the apartment, but she can also adapt to the surroundings. She can adapt to the weather and actually feel what it likes to be like outside in the rain or the cold or whatever. You know, the technology is that advanced that it can actually make the hologrammatic projection feel what it is to be like, whatever surrounding they happen to be in. So that's an incredible advancement in technology right there. And also helps add to her humanity as a character. The film really does take its time to explore these ideas. And this is why the film is 2 hours and 40 minutes long. Because it slows down to explore these relationships and these ideas about advanced technology. But it also likes to flip it on its head to the negative sometimes. Not all of these are positives. The film constantly reminds us that joy is manufactured. Just as you're warming to what seems like a free-thinking AI, out in the rain experiencing it for the first time, she's suddenly put on freeze by an incoming call from Kay's boss. And you can see how much this distresses Kay, as he was in the moment, living that moment with her, as she was feeling and enjoying the rain for the first time. It's a moment that he helped create, and then it literally gets put on hold. The image of joy is literally frozen in front of him as this call comes in. So it destroys that fantasy. But the film later tries to tell us that although she's this thing that makes us perhaps think that she's just a product, puts it into an emotional context from her point of view later, when they've crashed the spinner and he's unconscious and she's trying to wake him up and gain his attention. He can't see or hear her because he's out for the count, but we can see her image fluctuating on repeat like a broken record. She's in distress for the man that she loves. So the feelings are real, even if the program is faltering in its limited capacity to interact as we do. So there's an argument there of, well, it's technology, but it's feeling at the same time. And then later on in the film, you have the scene when she brings home, or she's invited over, should I say, the prostitute character, because she wants her lover to feel interactive love on a physical level, and there's a prolonged sequence that basically exploits the idea of an AI, a hologrammatic AI, being able to sort of move with the physical body of someone that's actually in with the room, so that she can actually interact with her man and he can still see her, even though, you know, the lines are still blurred, the technology isn't fully up to date in the sense of she's completely covering up the woman that she's trying to create a shell over. But the, you know, it's a really, really, really fascinating idea that I've never seen done in cinema before, and it was such a wonderful thing for them to sort of explore here, because you think that's actually might what happen in the future if we have this technology available. People who, because Kay is a replicant, he can't necessarily just go out and find an ordinary girlfriend. He's had to buy a product to keep him company, and the fact that this technology is now at the state where, although he can't touch her, she can get someone else to be the body for her. And the technology is good enough that she can actually sync up with a human body so that she can interact with her man. It's a fascinating idea. And, you know, is it possibly something that will happen in the future? Who knows? Yeah, but it was a very, very interesting scene to see. But Joy, at one point, wants to also give him a real name. When he thinks that he's discovered that he is a real man, she wants to give him a name. She wants to get rid of the K number, and she says she wants to call him Joe, and it's a name that he adopts. But again, the final point in the Joy Program argument is after she's gone, when he encounters the giant advert at the end of the film before he goes off to rescue Deckard. It's a giant hologrammatic advertisement in the middle of the city that actually talks to people as they walk by, and he's the only one there, so she's interacting with him, this advertisement, and she refers to him as a good Joe. So clearly Joy's limited capacity to even name him was relegated to that one name that came with her advertising programming. So it's kind of a downbeat sort of note on the Joy thing there. This is a bit of a downer for him, as all he's left with is the memory of what he had with her, and now this advert taking part of that away from him. You know, what was special, her trying to cheer him up and give him a name, is now no longer special because it's something that the advert itself uses. This leaves Kay alone, despondent, and it actually pushes him, I guess, to make the decision to be as unselfish as he can and fight to rescue and save Deckard and reunite him with the actual real child in the movie. So Kay literally has to have everything taken away from him in order to find his real humanity in the real things. I think Kay believes in putting these two people back together, and that earns him his true humanity in the end. So that's how I sort of see the sort of purpose of Joy in the movie. And there are other scenes, you know, you can make commentary on when he first comes home and she's and they're entertaining each other and so on. But I don't want to go on about this forever because you literally can't just talk about this film for ages. So I'll talk about Love, who is probably my favorite character in the film. I think Sylvia Hoeks, the actress, who I've not seen in anything else before, did a sterling job of what literally could have just been like I said, the sidekick to the bad guy. So the character of Love, I mean, she has some very interesting scenes with her creator, master, if you will. Scenes with him where she's standing in the background witnessing what's going on. Like when Neander Wallace goes to look at a new replicant line that's being created and he cuts it open. And he's basically just furious because he wants this child that's been discovered because his own technology can't do what he wants it to do, which is to create their own babies. And it's a wonderful scene where he, well, wonderful scene, it's a graphic scene where he basically just kills this brand new naked, off the line, off the rack model that has been created and talks about his frustration. And it's watching Love standing in the background, you know, with tears forming in her eyes as he's doing the performing this cruelty. And the cruelty's hit that home much more. And I only noticed this on my second viewing is that he's blind, but he sees with these weird little sort of floating devices that are tapped into a device on his neck so he can, I guess, see or sense what's going on in the room. And there's like four or five of these things floating around, and one of them is right next to Love's head during this scene. So he's clearly keeping an eye on her while he's operating, as it were, on the model in front of him. Oh yes, we have to say he's a very cruel master. But again, later on in the film, when Deckard is being talked to by Wallace, Love again is there in the background, and you can see her reacting to things every now and again. And it's just a fascinating character to watch. But the real meat of what goes on is her interactions generally with Ryan Gosling's character. She's sent in as a buffer, basically. Ryan Gosling goes to do some research about the character of Rachel, whose bones they found. This is a lot near the beginning of the film. So she's sent in as a buffer to intervene on the company's behalf at a high level so she can detect what's going on. And there's some wonderful multi-layering of character interaction between Love and Kay throughout the film. On the one hand, you have her clearly superior to Kay in strength, but also in her attempts to analyze him. But you can also read it in more of an emotional sense that perhaps she isn't as perfect as she thinks she is, rejected by Kay and despises that from him. The first pause in her confidence is when Kay refers to her as a thing that's been given a name. He's surprised that she's been given an actual name. He's like, oh, he named you. And she's almost offended by this. She's quite taken aback by that, that Kay has noticed that she's been given an actual name by her master. And the drama heightens in the room where they listen to Deckard and Rachel's audio fragment interaction. Both Kay and Love together seem to be working together in their observations. Kay notices that Rachel likes Deckard because she's being sort of testy with him on the audio fragment. Love builds on this theory with the fact that people like to be asked personal questions. She says it makes them feel desired. She then perhaps clumsily, almost straight away, asks Kay a personal question, and he shuts it down. He just looks at her blankly and shuts it down. But you can read her interaction with him two ways, and this is obviously the great thing about any film, where you can read things in multiple ways. But the two ways that I like to look at this is this because she desires him, or is it merely a part of her ploy to gain his trust in conversation, so she can learn more for her own needs? The film has strong arguments for both throughout. And that said, Kay merely just shuts down the conversation by saying, tell your boss thank you for your time. It doesn't say it like that, but it gives her nowhere to go. So she has to sort of get on with her job and realise that she's got nowhere else that she can go with that. He gives her no further information and also abruptly lets it know that that he doesn't need to be desired by her and has no fear for personal attention from her. But the actress, Sylvia Hoeks, just makes this work so well. Just with the subtle looks, the subtle nods that she makes as he's speaking, the way that her eyes are sort of following him as he talks, and the gestures that she makes. Just a superb performance. Her character is on full manipulation, basically. She sort of suckers the lab technician into thinking that she has the right to be there in the morgue area before she breaks the back of his spine with a quick chop to the back of the neck. It's a cheap shot. It's basically one of those cheap, hey, look at this while I distract you tricks. But it's an effective one that works. And when she encountered Robin Wright's character later in the film, she starts off from one standpoint and then it quickly turns into another. So she's always being fake in what she's doing with whoever she's interacting with. She's not being true to what she wants, and certainly not in what she says, until later in the film when she lets loose and basically loses her temper. I think love scenes are about juxtaposing what we see and hear, as opposed to what the actual intent is. And the scene with Robin Wright character, Lieutenant Joshi, starts quite suddenly. Love basically storms into the office. He was clicking on the ground, comes into the office, and immediately just changed the light. She puts the lights on when she comes in because it's quite a dim room. And so already she's commanding the room as she's entered it. She takes one cold look at Robin Wright's character and basically says, you know, she starts saying a few compliments about Kay's character. But the moment that those words are past her lips, and I think the last thing she says is, he's a good boy. But the moment those words are past her lips, she demands, where is he? She literally takes a step forward and, where is he? So Joshi knows full well what's going on here. So she plays the I don't know game. But then she addresses the elephant in the room about the missing child and states what Kay told her earlier, that the child has been destroyed. Not just killed, but destroyed. So perhaps a little too smug for it, for her own good, but she's still perhaps annoyed by the fact that one of her staff were murdered by Love earlier on and that the bones were stolen. And it's at this point where Love's only response is to crush Joshi's hand and the glass that she's holding in her hand in a tight grip. So she's got all this broken glass in her hand as Love has grasped her. Causing a lot of intense pain, and Robin Wright plays this very well, I must say. But Love's expression starts to tremble, and tears start to well up in her face. Although she's angry, she's trying to keep her voice low, but you can clearly see that she's trembling as she's speaking to her, because she responds to the fact, calls her a tiny thing, you know, and it's basically, how dare you, how could you kill something that was so brave and so new, and it's basically because you're afraid that you did that. So it's basically from one species to another, she's making this argument about what they have done for something that was beautiful and bold and is obviously a threat to mankind. And Joshi, despite the pain, manages one more respite to Love, basically saying, yeah, well, I did it anyway. And it's at this point where Love's restraint breaks, and we hear her for the one and only time lose her composure and shouts. She basically howls at her, you know, where is he? In this ungodly voice. It's a terrific piece of acting in this scene, it really is. But both of them are magnetic, but it shows you how well they've developed this henchman character into something much more multi-layered. You don't often get a synthetic person crying, screaming, taunting, and then even murdering someone on screen, and you feel their emotional pain. You know, you can see their side of an argument, as it were. And Love is quite an advanced model, so she can clearly break the rules of what a replicant can or can't do to a human character or to someone else. And she even states that she will pretend to her boss, she will basically go back and say that she was under threat and therefore had to defend herself, when it's actually, in fact, she's not under any threat and she's just going to straight out murder Lieutenant Joshi, which she does with a quick slash to the gut, and then this great shot where it's from outside the office where you just see her arm very robotically thrust into her gut. And then she falls over dead. And it's at that point where she has to get into her computer to find out where Kay's gone. And there's this darkly comedic beat after this where she uses Joshi's head, because she's got to activate a scan on the computer to make it work. So she's holding her body up by her head to get this scan to her. The moment that the scan is said, you know, yes, access granted, she lets go of Joshi and her head bashes on the table before it slumps onto the floor with the rest of her body, where it drags it down afterwards. It's a wonderfully sort of blackly comedic moment. Even after Joshi's dead, Love just has that much contempt for her. Now, the next time she sees Kay, she does some real damage to his life. I mean, she kicks the living crap out of him, first of all. And although she has the upper hand, she insists on throwing verbal spite at him as well. I mean, clearly she hates this character, this guy who she couldn't get the upper hand on, the upper wit on earlier on. So first of all, she calls him a bad dog. She's clearly adamant on making sure that he knows that she thinks that that he's beneath her. But then she goes on to destroy the actual love of Kay's life, which is his holographic girlfriend. And it's a malicious move, and perhaps it's brought on by Love's own hatred for him. I'm sure it is, as someone who is sort of been rejected by even his even basic interest of even just having a conversation with someone. So she goes on to focus on this thing that's on the floor, and it basically screws him over. Well, she's done it physically, and now she's screwed him over mentally as well by removing Joy from his life and from existence, because once that sort of remote control is destroyed, Joy is gone for good. And then the next time they meet is obviously the climax, the action climax, where they go head-to-head again. And it's a brutal fight out in the crashing water and rain. And again, Love appears to have the upper hand for the better part. Again, she has him down on the ground, affirming to him that she's the best one, which all but confirms her emotional insecurity about herself, which again, like I said, is the fascinating aspect of that character, just the emotional insecurity that she has about her own identity, despite whatever strengths that she has. Joy and Kay's relationship shows us certain layers of where AI could go, and where it may be limited, but Love shows a different aspect to that. In effect, it's micromanaging human qualities, making it more interesting analysis for us as viewers, I guess, merely because they are synthetic creations. Knowing that they are replicants in our minds is what makes us maybe view them differently. As viewers, we view them differently because we know that they are synthetic, perhaps even more voyeuristic than it would be if they were actually human characters with the exact same emotional flaws. It makes it that much more interesting knowing that they are something that aren't quite human, and therefore exploring these ideas of what it is to be human becomes infinitely more interesting because it's from the standpoint of something that isn't. And that's the great thing that Blade Runner, now as a series, has the ability to do, to create characters like this that are broken. They're just as broken as we are. And even, you know, by showing us some of the perfection that they have as well. But this film advances those ideas in many fresh ways, lots of fresh ways. I like how she's also not like a Roy Batty clone. She's in many ways very different. But don't get me wrong, she's up for the preservation of Replicant's future, definitely. But even as Roy Batty went out of life having grasped it and understood it, his death is acceptance and peaceful. Blissful in that he knows something we have yet to fully appreciate. Love goes out screaming and clawing against death as it approaches. She felt, unproven on her journey, battled her corners as hard as she could, but upon the peak of her triumph, she is forced against her will into the grip of death. Watching her wail furiously underwater, under Kay's grip, is just an astonishing thing to behold. It was just such an angry performance from Hoax as she did this, just refusing to give up in the angriest sort of face you've ever seen in film in a long time, like a child that's not getting its way and it's just railing and wailing against whatever it is that's holding it down. But eventually life does leave her, and it's clearly a total shock to her as she goes out, unable to fight it. It's an amazing performance, and probably, my favourite character in the whole film. I have to say, though, considering how much screen time... I think she actually has more screen time than the character of Joy. She definitely has more screen time than Robin Wright's character. I think, if you know, screen time-wise, I think she's probably got the second amount of screen time next to Ryan Gosling. But I was surprised that she was left off of the poster advertising, because the poster is mainly... Kay and then Rick Deckard on the other side, and then Joy and... Neander Wallace, he's in it for like three scenes, if that. It's an odd one why they left her off of the poster campaign, because she's so it's relevant, you know, what she is and what she does in the film to what's going on. Yeah, you know, it's a key factor to the themes that the film touches upon. But there you go, I guess. Yeah. So that's the main things that I wanted to sort of talk about. Like I said, I could literally do a whole commentary on this film, talk about every scene, the lighting, the way things are set up, the things that I thought. Was there anything in this film that didn't work? Yeah, there was a couple of things, but they're not noteworthy to the point where I think it's detrimental to the film. It's just that you could remove them from the film and it wouldn't matter. I think the key thing you could remove from this is the Edward James Olmos cameo. It's pointless. It doesn't really tell us anything. It doesn't lead us anywhere. But it's nice to see him. I think I would have liked it more if he still did the city speak that he did in the original film. Anyone watching this film that's not seen the original will be like, who the hell's that? In fact, anyone that's not familiar with Edward James Olmos and his look might still say, who the hell's that? Because he's obviously a lot older. He looks very different. And he sounds... very different. It's weird, you know, he's just an old guy in an old folks home in this film. It was a very, very strange choice. So I'd leave that out. Ford. Now, there's always the question of, is Deckard a replicant? Maybe, maybe not. The film leaves it open. He's never referred to directly as such. He's gotten older. And it's clear that older models didn't age, really. They had a limited lifespan. Was he, if he is a replicant, built to last, as it were? It's never stated that he might be a newer model made back then that would last. You could read that way, most definitely, especially as Wallace basically wants to dissect him to find out how he got Rachel pregnant. If he was merely a human, it may not be such a point of interest. He might be like, well, he's human, so it doesn't matter what's inside him, what makes him tick. They don't have to study. Well, they don't have her to study, though, do they? Except her bones. But the child, they think, is gone. All they've got is these bones and no answers. So maybe having Deckard, if he is human, around to study might help anyway. You know, it's the one like last clue that they've got. But then again, they're clutching at straws if that is the case, and therefore any minor connection to the creation of the child would be a good thing for them. But as it was a miracle, so maybe they have to study him regardless. But you can also read it as he is a replicant. Clearly, I think it's to the film's and the writer's credit that they don't address him directly that way. You can assume it one way or the other. It's not even a point of contention really for as viewers. Is he? Isn't he? It's just totally up to you from whatever version of the first film that you preferred. The theatrical or the director's or final cut, whether you think he's a replicant or not, it's great that it's still up to you. It's not being given to you definitively, and that is an amazing thing for a sequel to do, to not provide an answer and keep mystery going. Quite often the opposite happens. So it's nice that both Scott's and Ford's version of the character happily coexist in this film. Yeah. So, right, I didn't want to go on for too long about this, so I'm at the half-hour mark now. That's just my thoughts on a few of the characters and some of the themes that are going on in the film. There are so many other things that can be talked about with this film, but I'm going to leave it there for now. See ya.